Yeah, people do ask a lot, gosh, you've got all these stories. And I'm like, I've just said yes a lot.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. I've just said yes and often and tried things. And the mud has a story. Yeah, you get in the mud, but the mud's got a story. And the mud's got a story that you're going to remember
because
it's personal. So we have to, as a society, reframe failure and reframe those kinds of things. We do it in business. Like, we're pretty good at that because we know we're going to make a lot of mistakes in business, but we're not very good when it comes to our personal lives at allowing us to make failures, because we're so worried that it's going to be attached to our identity, that it somehow says something about us at the core of our being, and it doesn't. It just says something we did, not who we are.
Right. Welcome to the Throwing Mountains podcast, where men are rediscovering courageous leadership and drawing strength from stories of God working in the lives of ordinary men today. Men who become leaders in their spheres of influence by relying on God and following Jesus. I'm co-host Chris Bollinger. Host Mike Hatch and I are big fans of the Bible Project, and we were excited to have Mike McDonald, Chief Global Focus and Strategic Relationships Officer for the Bible Project, on the podcast late in the summer of 2023. We expected to get a lot of details on the terrific resources that the Bible Project provides. But once Mike McDonald started telling his fence post story, the interview went in a direction we didn't expect. It ended up being one of the best interviews we've had. I did my best to capture the highlights here, but I edited out a lot of great stuff. At the end of the highlights, I'll give the episode number of the complete interview. Here are highlights from our interview with Mike McDonald.
And so, Mike, we'd love to hear a little bit about your background and share some of your fence posts, those significant moments that made you who you are today. And I'm just getting ready. I'm buckling in for the ride because I think this is going to be a great story. So, Mike, tell us a little bit about yourself, man.
Yeah, gosh. I'll say my fence posts come from some brokenness and pain as well as some success and some great folks in my life. They're going to be a mixture of those for sure, but I grew up in a small little town in Canada, little ski town called Nelson, BC, draft dodging kind of hippie town. My dad left when I was 3, so I never knew him. Mom married kind of an abusive, pretty gnarly stepdad. We had foster kids in our home, sexually abused our foster kids, and just a really kind of gnarly home life. Mom was manic depressive bipolar, and so also had some struggles with her mental health, especially with me when I was a kid. I had a younger brother as well.
Wow.
And so I feel like I had to grow up really fast as a kid just because of that. The home environment wasn't super secure, so I was often out of the home. I got my first job when I was 10 at a sewing center, sorting their bills, because he hadn't done like taxes in 10 years. So that I could buy like, you know, my basketball shoes or different things that I wanted to do. We didn't have very much money either. So I'd say that's part of the post, just in terms of having to grow up as fast as I had to grow up, which was not recommended at all. And I also grew up Baha'i. I didn't grow up in the church. So I grew up in the Baha'i faith, which is a faith out of Iran, out of the 1850s, kind of an offshoot of Islam, with some very different distinctives around equality between men and women, equality between races, equality between religion. And so my mom, as a good Baha'i, sent myself and my younger brother, who was 12, to China for 6 weeks on our own.
Oh my gosh.
To go to a women's conference about the injustice of what's happening around the world for women. And it was about 40,000 folks. Hillary Clinton spoke, Sally Field, a bunch of different people.
Wow.
But you can imagine jumping on a plane at 14 with a 12-year-old brother with a backpack and an envelope with $2,000 in it to go for 6 weeks. We had no hotel booked. I mean, it was literally just like get off the plane and into Beijing and go figure it out.
Before 9/11, you could do that, though.
You
I remember
could.
People
oh, yeah.
sending kids on flights, you
totally.
Know, just saying, go, and yeah,
yep.
That's crazy.
Take off and go explore the world. So my mom was definitely like a hit. I mean, she lived in a cave in the Canary Islands when she was 19, and she had done that herself at a young age, and so I think she just thought it'd be great. And we did come back alive, so it wasn't all horrible. But I would say that was another almost fence post around just, wow, we can do hard things. We can figure things out. We can find a hotel. There was all the hotels were booked because it was this huge conference. So we ended up finding there's this building kind of close to the conference that had not been finished getting built yet. The roof would still have the barbed wire stuff on the top, and the doors weren't in, and the walls were still that kind of chalky cement, you know, like it just not finished. But I convinced the landlord to let me and my brother stay there and pay rent to be in one of these like rooms because we couldn't find a hotel. So I went and bought our bedding and all of that kind of stuff. Anyway, and one little offshoot too. When we first got off the airplane, we try to get on the bus and it's just so many people. And I get on and my 12-year-old brother gets squished because of people trying to get on the bus as well. The doors close, the bus leaves, and he's outside on the road in Beijing. I'm like, day one, I've lost my brother. I'm never going home. And I get off, probably it felt like forever, but it, I don't know, it's 20 minutes later. But how many turns? I'm bawling. I don't know what to do. I get off. I'm just standing there going, do I try to work my way back to where I was? So I waited, and about an hour and a half later, there Chris comes. And my brother's name's Chris. This is great. there my brother comes on the bus, the only white kid on this bus. And we embrace. But the poor guy like had such culture shock. He did not leave that room for 6 weeks. He did not go to the conference. He just stayed put.
This would be a movie, yeah, but I don't think anybody would believe this if it were a movie. I mean,
no, I know. It's just wild. And what's so crazy, too, is my brother came back, huge culture shock, stays in Nelson until he's in his early 20s, and then goes, I got to get out of Nelson. I got to go do something. And the only place that he thought of was China. So he moved to China. I'm not joking. He moved to China, marries a gal from there, has two kids. They're amazing. Rose, I've got a little nephew and niece.
Wow.
But it's just full
circle.
You
didn't speak China. You didn't speak Mandarin, did you?
We didn't speak anything. We spoke Canadian. I mean, we didn't even speak. I mean, it was.
We could spend an hour just on this story. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Right. So I would say that was a post. So I left when I was 17. I graduated early and left home, moved to Calgary, Alberta, got a job there at a clothing store. And this is so stupid. The manager in the first week of me being there gets caught stealing from the safe. And so the owners come in, and there's a multi-store company. Owners come in, and they're interviewing everybody, because usually what happens when the manager steals, I'm 17, the manager's stealing from the safe, usually the rest of the staff are too, because they rope it in so that no one tells on one another, right, and they can make this whole thing out of it. So the owners sit down with me, and they're like, hey, would you consider managing the store for a month? And I'm like, guys, I've been here a week. I'm 17. I don't know what I'm, like, there's... No, that would be a bad idea. And they're like, well, as long as you don't steal from the safe, you'll be doing better than the last guy. And I'm like, I can do that. That's something. So they give me the store. In the first week, I fire everybody because I'm in the health food store on my days off, looking, it's across the way, looking in and just watching everybody steal. And I'm just writing down name. Like, there, Misty stole a pair of jeans. Brenda stole this. Mark stole this. Wow. And so I throw a staff meeting, and I'm like, all right, I got a list. Everybody, every single one of you have stolen. Here's the dates you stole. Here's what you stole. You got two options. You leave here, you quit, you sign this thing that you're quitting. Or two, I fire you and you'll never work another day in your life because you are a thief. Like, I'm talking, I don't know any of this stuff. I'm just like totally, I'm doing this so horribly. I'm completely talking out of my butt.
You know what, though? It shows that maturity that you were forced to develop over time. I feel like what you said earlier is playing out right now in this story.
Yeah, I just didn't know anything else to do. So let everybody go. Then I realize I'm like, I'm also like the only person now who works here. So I'm having to open and close. And so I start hiring people, training them on just selling clothes and working the cash register. Lo and behold, in a month, the sales go through the roof and the theft goes down. To almost nothing, to normal amounts of clothing theft in a store. So the owners come back and they're like, listen, man, the store is going great. Do you want to just do this? We'll pay you 45 grand a year. And granted, this was almost 30 years ago. We'll pay you 45 grand a year. And I thought I'd just won the lottery. I'll do that. But I take the bus every day too. It's getting a little hard. Like, we'll buy you a car. So they bought me a car and gave me the salary to manage the store. So I'm like, I'm not going to college. I'm not doing any. This is my life. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Year and a half into working in a mall, realize, and nothing against people that work in malls, I was getting done working in a mall for a year and a half. And no sunlight, and just, you know, you feel like you're in a casino. You don't know what time it is at any point in the day. So I left on a find myself trip, kind of eat, pray, love style. Again, still a Baha'i, to Turkey. and I go
for... I thought you were going to say China.
But. Yeah, I should have gone back. I go to Turkey, and I met a missionary in Cappadocia from Australia named Mark, who had been there for 6 months trying to reach Muslims for the gospel. And he hadn't talked to anybody yet. I mean, he'd been there 6 months. He just hadn't found a way to have a conversation. So he got some Baha'i Canadian kid instead, where we met. And we had a similar story. His dad left when he was young. We were just talking about, what are you doing here? I'm figuring out who I am, and didn't have a father and didn't have somebody leading me in that direction and guiding me in what I should do. So he starts sharing the gospel through that story and basically opened up the Bible and said, hey, have you ever read through one of the gospels? And I'm like, well, I've read the Bible. I'm Baha'i. Baha'is believe in Jesus. So we believe that the Bible is authoritative and scripture, et cetera. And he's like, man, read through one of the gospels and let's talk about it tomorrow. That was his way of sharing the gospel. He's just like, read one of these and let's talk about it. So I went to my little place, opened up the Bible to the first book in the New Testament, just Matthew. I didn't know to start in John. No one told me or whatever. Like I didn't know where to. So I just opened up Matthew and I read through the whole gospel of Matthew. And in that evening, gave my life to Jesus that night. What I heard when I read through Matthew was Jesus is Lord. Jesus is king. The things that he did were so much different than what Baha'u'llah did, the prophet for the Baha'is. He's healing people. He's just all the things. For me, I was like, oh, I think I'm following the wrong dude. I think I need to be following this. And so in my own language, and at that moment, I got picked up. Just I felt like I got picked up for the first time in my life, like almost wow. levitated, like just carried. Yeah. And went back and obviously told Mark this, and he opened up some other scripture about baptism. And again, didn't tell me I need to get, but he just read scripture. That's all he did. He was just opening up scripture. Like, all right, you know, this happened. And then these guys got in the water, and I'm like, I guess I'm supposed to get in the water. And so he baptized me there in Turkey. And then I came home, and this was pre Facebook and internet as an everyday kind of thing and cell phones. I didn't have a cell phone. So I have no contact with Mark, like zero. To this day, it's just like, great, thanks, man. And then had no idea the change in my life that was about to take place. Because being a Baha'i was a part of me, but it wasn't all of me. It wasn't like how being a Jesus follower just consumes every part of your life in nook and cranny. It wasn't like that for me as a Baha'i. So I didn't realize the journey I was about to go on in this. So I come back to Calgary. So that would be a major fence post. Mark and reading and coming to faith through the scriptures, I would also say, has been something that has been super important for my life, just because I didn't go to church for 2 years when I came back. I didn't even know to go to a church. I'd been to a few and I felt they were super judgmental and super clicky. So I just didn't want to be a part of that. So I just kept reading. I just would read the scriptures and talk to God through my reading.
Are you all by yourself at this point, Mike? Do you have friends in Calgary? Because you left for a while. Do you have anybody in your life?
I left for a month and a half. I've got some friends, but when I came back to Calgary, I got a job at a restaurant. I thought I wanted to go to school. One of the things that happened in Turkey was, as I was praying, like, what do I do with my life? God really impressed on me to care for those that were like me when I was younger. So there's a lot of fatherless kids. There's a lot of folks that don't have mentorship, direction. And so go live a life that allows you to do that was kind of what I was hearing. And I thought when I looked at it, I was like, great, well, that's a teacher. Those are the only people I could think of in my life that were the constant figures that were really good. And I can remember some of those teachers, you know, today that were just so impactful in my life. So I came back. I thought I was going to go to college to be a teacher. I needed to pay for it, though. So I went and got a job at a restaurant. The GM of the restaurant, this guy, Lane, hired me, took me under his wing and asked me to get into management. And I was like, I've done the management thing. I think I want to be a teacher. And he was like, well, why do you want to be a teacher? And I told him, I said, hey, I had this experience. I feel like I've got a bunch of people like me that I want to pour out to. And he goes, man, I want you to watch what I do for a month and then let's talk. And I'm like, okay. And that's what he did. I mean, he had a staff, about 200 staff at this restaurant, it's a big restaurant, and he would sit with every single person that worked that day for like 5-10 minutes. That's all he did. That was his whole day, was just sitting with people. He had a little booth, table 110, I remember. He'd sit down, someone would sit down with him, and he would ask them like, okay, how's everything going in your life? What's going on at home? What's going on at school? It was never about serving. It was about life. And I was like, gosh, that's what I want to do. So I ended up getting into restaurant management. He trained me up. I took over my first restaurant when I was 20 up in Edmonton. And then I just kept opening up restaurants for this company that had just really started a few years before. And now it's 60 restaurants and a bunch of, I think, I don't even know how many they have now, but they've just opened up a number in the U.S. That's what made me come down to the U.S. I was a part of the group that brought the chain down to the U.S. We had bought a a restaurant chain off of Wolfgang Puck, with 7 in Seattle and 1 here in Portland. I moved to Portland, was traveling back and forth between Portland and Seattle, opening these up. And Lane, to this day, is still one of my largest mentors. And that would be another pillar, like finding really good mentors in your life with consistency that really know you and that are willing to honestly tell you things and also be there to really listen. So Lane has been an incredible mentor in that. Came down to Portland, was doing the restaurant, but a year and a half in, decided that it was not for me through a number of events. I was engaged to a gal in Canada. That broke off. I kind of tailspinned. Restaurant was really not going well because it was this failing restaurant from Wolfgang Puck that we were getting ready to renovate into Joey's, but we weren't there yet. And so that wasn't very fun. But Lane, in a brilliant moment, was like, buddy, you need a win. And I don't care if it's a win in your work life, Joey's. I don't care if it's a win in your personal life, like dating or whatever. And I don't care if it's a win in what you believe in around church and stuff. He wasn't a believer, but he's like, dude, pick something in your life, a big part, and you've got to focus in on that because right now you're spinning. And so I focused on church. I was just like, you know, the thing that I'm excited about is like this church, this little new church plant called the Mago Day Community in Portland that I'm excited about. And he's like, great, focus in on that, do something. And so I just put all my energy into that. And sure enough, I got a ton of great friends in there. I started leading the usher teams. And everything started spinning back the right way. For me, it was a little bit of a moment going, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I don't want to actually do restaurants. I actually think I want to serve this community and figure out how to have more people have that experience. And so I left the restaurant. I actually got a job at Imago, and I started a nonprofit called the Mentoring Project with Donald Miller. And so Don and I both grew up without dads. He was writing a book about growing up without a dad called To Own a Dragon, a great book. He wanted to find a nonprofit to give profits of that book to that were mentoring kids. And we honestly just couldn't find one that we really had a lot of synergy with. There's Big Brothers, Big Sisters. There's lots of ones out there. But we couldn't really find what's the church's response to the crisis of fatherlessness. And how do you bring dads actually into that equation as opposed to just young college students that take an hour out of their day, which is awesome. And I keep doing that. But we really thought, what would it look like to bring fathers into that space? And we started asking the questions, what would that, how could that be possible? And most dads were like, I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to give an hour or two. I've got my own kids. I've got my own family. I've got work. And we created a little bit of an idea and a system around, well, what if you just brought Jimmy, the kid, into what you're already doing versus just leaving what you're doing to go take care of Jimmy for an hour a week? And so if you're going to the movies with your kids. Yeah, totally similar to my experience. Just bring them along. If you're going to the movie, bring Jimmy along. If you're going camping, bring Jimmy along. If you're just having dinner at your house, bring Jimmy. If you're going grocery shopping, like how do you just invite these fatherless kids into that type of environment? So that is where I went down the nonprofit route and took me down that journey. From there, I met John Mark Comer and Phil Comer when they were planting a church up here in Portland called Solid Rock. They asked me to come and be a part of that, and I did. It's also where I met my wife, which would be a major pillar. My wife's an incredible, incredible human, therapist, married 15, almost 16 years, which means I've been in like full-time therapy for 16 years.
I was going to say that has to be a little helpful.
Yeah, very helpful. Oh, my God.
But also maybe frustrating at times.
Yeah, I think frustration early, and then what you do is you realize, wow, it's actually really helpful. It's really hard to come against some of the things that are hard, but man, so helpful and healthy. So yeah, she's my biggest pillar for sure. And that trip in China, to talk about pillars, like that trip in China to not just from the travel side, but actually from what we were learning, like what I was learning as a 14-year-old male, white male, around the injustice of women all around the world and what's happening when it comes to human trafficking, when it comes to abuse, et cetera, definitely shaped my theology, like everything. It has shaped everything from an early stage. And so getting into the areas of injustice when it comes to human trafficking, when it comes to refugee care, when it comes to orphan care and education, et cetera, definitely, I think, was birthed out of that experience in a lot of ways, because there were so many women from all those countries coming and sharing stories and personal stories and testimonies.
Yeah,
I'd met Bob Goff through the Mentoring Project because Don and I had met Bob and he became one of our first kind of mentor type folks even at the project and became friends. Bob was traveling around to Uganda and doing education there. So I just started actually traveling with him.
I forgot that he did that. He's like,
He's the Ugandan consulate. He was opening up schools in Uganda. I started traveling with him to do that. And anytime we're going to travel, we're just going to do it together. That just made sense. And so we were going on a lot of trips primarily to do that work. Mm. I was a part of a little nonprofit out of the church called Hear the Cry that was doing similar work in orphan care, refugee care, and a human trafficking work.
A key partner for the Throwing Mountains podcast is the men's ministry CLC, Christ-Led Communities. CLC strives to build authentic community through the uncommon pursuit of Christ, and it has had an incredible impact on the lives of tens of thousands of men, including Mike Hatch and me. If you're like most men, then you have many male acquaintances, but few or even no trusted male friends. With CLC, you'll join with other men around the person and work of Jesus Christ, and powerful things will happen. You'll see masks removed and honest brotherhood begin. CLC is much more than a Bible study. It's a relational pathway that equips men for a lifetime of biblically based leadership. For more information, go to clchq.org or email Mike Hatch at mhatch@clchq.org.
With Bible Project, John Collins, one of the co-founders, I knew from Imago from 20 years ago. We actually had hired him to do our very first video on this thing called Advent Conspiracy. It was this whole kind of movement that we had with a bunch of churches. And he did the film, and it was like kind of one of the first like explainer videos explaining this whole concept. And it kickstarted him into what he started doing for work, which was he had a couple studios doing explainer videos for like huge companies, though, like Google, Apple, you know, big companies. When a company had a hard, complex idea to share and needed to figure out how to do that, they called John. John's studio is the studio to do that. And so if you remember when you first heard of Google Cloud or like cloud computing, Google called John, and John flew up to Google, and they explained what this whole new thing is that's coming out in whatever 6 months. And so he would pepper them with questions and write the script and get to the point where he thought he could explain it. And then he wrote those commercials, animated those commercials. I mean, he was the guy that did all of that. So that's John's background. And then Tim's like our full Bible nerd route. They were friends from college, but he went, did master's, doctorate, lived over in Israel, came back, did all that. So when Bible Project started, from the very beginning, because of John and because of Tim, and we're here in Portland, and I'm doing this kind of stuff, it's a small world over here in Portland. I just knew about it. I'd often work out of John's studio once a week just to be out of my own environment. And so I got to see some of these early videos coming out and was super excited. I felt like I learned more in 5 minutes than I did in a whole seminary class. I'm like, these are going to be phenomenal, overseas especially. Like, I couldn't wait to bring these over to pastors and leaders in Uganda and Zimbabwe and Somalia and all these places that have no resources. And so that's where my journey with Bible Project began, was just very from the kind of get-go. And then as Bible Project was looking at growing globally into other languages, into other platforms, is when John and Tim approached me about jumping on and doing that with Bible Project. Part of it is that I just don't know. I didn't go to college and didn't learn some of that stuff. I didn't grow up in the church, so I didn't have frameworks that this is just the way that we do it inside of these institutions. And so the way that I would approach many of those problems was from a very blank slate or a very ignorant state. And it didn't allow us to make a lot of mistakes, too. I'm not saying it's all roses, because we made a boatload of mistakes because we didn't know what we were doing. But that never stopped us from trying to keep going forward. Right. Mistakes or failures or whatever you want to call them, for me, were just incredible learnings.
Sure.
They were not like, let's stop doing something, but it was more like, okay, I learned a really valuable lesson there, and that's going to follow me for the rest of my life, and now I get to try something new. When Bible Project's incredible to get to be at, where we get to still try new things. Right. We're in that place where we're still getting to like, maybe this won't work, maybe it will work, but let's give it a shot.
It's the entrepreneurial mindset, in my opinion. For me, there's no substitute for, if you're not in a startup or an entrepreneurial environment, just having that mindset. In my little sphere, what can I do? What can my team do that's innovative? I think there's a need for innovation.
Yeah, I'll never forget. We were in Uganda. Bob had heard of this space that gals were getting trafficked. And he was like, Mike, we got to open up a home. Let's open up a home for these gals, get them into a home. We'll get them into a school. We'll just do this. And I'm like, yeah, sounds great. Thinking like, we'll write a plan up and we'll figure it out. He goes, how much money do you have in your bank account? I'm like, oh, gosh, I don't know. And so I pull out $3,000 or whatever, and he pulls out some money. And no joke, within 24 hours, we had rented a place in the capital of Uganda, in Kampala. Got some social workers that we've befriended through some phone calls, even just being like, hey, can you come talk to us about this? And then like within a week, there was like 8 girls that had been trafficked in their community and are now in this safe home. And I remember me, even with my entrepreneurial spirit, even being a little reserved, being like, hey, Bob, what if we screw it up? What happens if these girls get trafficked out of the home? Or what happens if I'm thinking of some of the things that could go wrong? And he's like, Mike, you're right. And we are going to make some mistakes. But I promise you that today is going to be better than yesterday for them. That's where I'm going. Yeah. I promise you that it will be better than what it's been. And yes, there's probably going to be other things that happen. But there's such a paralysis sometimes when we worry about all the things that could happen. And he's just like, they probably are going to happen, but let's just make it better. And that stuck with me in so many areas of life where I just want to make it better than yesterday. Each iteration of myself continues to hone in on not just what I'm good at, but what do I want to do? And where does my team get to flourish around me and everything else? So yeah, I feel like I keep honing in. One thing I learned is because I used to have to run my own thing, and that was fine. I was a GM for a long time. I'm an owner operator. And what I personally realized 7 years ago is I'm just a really good number two. I can do that job and I've had success in that job, but it actually is not the most life-giving to me. The most life-giving to me and my family and to my psyche and all of those things is actually just to be a really good support and be on a team where I can help shape and yes, have enough authority with the responsibility to make it make sense, but also to not have to always be the one that's leading and driving that. And culture tells you that that's what you should be doing. And it took me a long time to go like, I don't need to climb that ladder. I don't need to. So part of handing off the nonprofit and even doing some of the pastoral work was actually realizing that about myself and going like, no, I think I just really want to be a good support on a team and be in a place like that. And so Bible Project, I feel like, is the newest iteration for myself in that experience around doing that. But absolutely all the things I've learned along the way have contributed to where I am now and being somewhat self-aware of what that all looks like. And the job is super, it's the best job in the world. I pinch myself. I really do. We give away everything for free. So there's no business development around more sales. That's not a thing. And our aim is to help people experience the Bible as unified story, at least to Jesus. So that's the mission, not anything else. It's so beautiful to get to go to organizations like Compassion or Alpha or Young Life or whoever and go, listen, let us help you because we have some incredible, it's all free. You can do whatever you want with it. And we're there for you. And if you care about helping your people understand the Bible in any sort of way, then let's do it. Let's do it together. And it's the easiest thing to get to show up and do that. So I love it. When I'm living in fear, there's something I don't trust, or there's often like shame or a fear of judgment, a fear of judgment from other folks, whatever it is. So whatever the insecure, I'm a 3 on the Enneagram. So a fear or a worry of what people think from a very young age has imparted itself into my being. I think for me, what I've had to have is people really speak truth over me often against those things that I know are just, they're part of my, everyone's got a little bit of a different bent on that. My wife's a 6. She's more fear-based around what's going to happen. Mine is just more like, how am I going to be perceived? Am I going to be left? Really, when it gets down to it, it's like, I don't believe that I'm lovable. I don't believe that I'm wanted. I'm sure some of that comes from my dad leaving when I was 3 and some other things. Mm-hmm. But my core belief is that I'm not good enough in that space. Mm-hmm. So I need people around me to speak truth into those things. And I need to be vulnerable enough, even with some of those other men, guys like Lane and others, to go, here's my core belief that's underneath all of this. I'm not lovable. I'm not good enough. I don't have what it takes. I need you to help speak against that and remind me that that's not true. Because I know that intellectually, I know that's not true. But man, there's something in me that, especially when anxiety or stress or certain things come up, that's going to be my like default place that I go to. And so it's where defensiveness comes from. It's where all those kind of things in my marriage will pop up. And so I think knowing yourself, and honestly, that could be counseling, that could be whatever that is for you, know yourself and be vulnerable and open with those things. And that's really scary for someone who's got fear. So I'm like, wait, be vulnerable, but I'm literally telling you I'm afraid.
Right.
especially for guys, but do it with a safe few. You don't need a million. You just need a few. And believe me, they're thinking this too. That's the beautiful thing about vulnerability, is it then begets vulnerability. If when I'm vulnerable with Lane about some of this stuff, it's amazing. He then is like, oh my gosh, I'm the same. Yeah. With this, with that. And so creating those safe places for that. Knowing what's true. For me, that is scripture, and that is having a personal understanding of what is true around who I am and my identity, all of that. That's massive. But we hear that in Bible class all the time. So I'm not trying to make that lip service, but even if it's just a few key verses that I go to in those anxiety, fear-based moments are super helpful for me to get into a place of that. Also prayer. I'll walk. I'm not a sit down and pray with people person. I'm not a pray out loud with a bunch of folks person, but I am a go on a walk and just be honest with God. And that took a little bit to get to realize the margins in my Bible are honestly riddled with things like, I disagree with this. This is brutal. I don't understand this. This is ridiculous. I'm actually really angry at this. This one, we're going to have a conversation about that is literally like the margins. But what's so freeing in that is to know God got space for that. Actually, yeah. He loves that because he knows it anyways. So he hates it when we're trying to hide something. So if I'm angry at God about something and I'm hiding it, I feel like I'm just Adam and Eve in the garden hiding. God goes, no, just bring that all to me. Talk to me about it. David did. And I love David. David would lament and yell and cry and be like, where the heck are you? Like, this is ridiculous. And we read those in these little like 10 verse chunks. Those would probably be weeks of experience, months of experience to write that one little lament. It still feels like they get solved within like 10 verses. I don't think they were getting solved in like a minute. I think he was like crying out, mad, angry, whatever, for months, and then has some resolution through that process of talking with God about it. And so that gives me a lot of just peace to go, I can bring that stuff to God. I can be vulnerable. And it's amazing when I pray and bring that to him, the peace that starts to come over, the fear that kind of disappears. And then the last thing I would say is just perspective. Like, we fear things we don't understand or we don't know. I've got a lot of people in our community that for the longest time were fearing the refugees coming in during multiple refugee crises. And they were worried about people bringing their religion in and people, all of the fears that would come in. And what I knew was they just don't know any of these people. Like, they've never met a Muslim refugee from Iraq that's trying to flee with their family because they love their kids so much and they love their family so much that they don't want to die. That's why they're here. So you sit down with someone who's got a lot of fear about refugees, and I bring in a friend of mine who's a refugee who just came from Iraq, and we sit down for lunch and we talk about family and we talk about kids and we talk about what they're passionate about, and you leave that place going, this isn't scary anymore. These are people just like me, and I would be doing the exact same thing they're doing. And so I think sometimes the things we fear are just things we don't understand. So I would just say, get into places, get into those places. If you fear, you know, where our school system's going, get into the school system, go meet those teachers, go get on the school, whatever you've got to do, step into those places. And it's amazing how, for me, at least personally, those things have disappeared. And that's where travel and perspective has been so helpful for me. Like, I don't fear other religions. I don't fear other people's belief systems because I've just sat with them all. And when I would sit with my Muslim friends in Iraq, I would go, tell me the best thing about being a follower of Muhammad and Islam. Tell me how that shaped and changed. I want to understand your faith and your life and all of that. Instead of coming and being like, you're an idiot and you should be doing it. Like, that's the way that we've approached this stuff for so long. Right. As opposed to a posture of learning. And I would say that has eradicated a lot of a fear in my life. So again, that's just me. Yeah, people do ask a lot, gosh, you've got all these stories. And I'm like, I've just said yes a lot. Yeah. That's really what it is. I've just said yes and often and tried things. And the mud has a story. Yeah, you get in the mud, but the mud's got a story. And the mud's got a story that you're going to remember because it's personal. So we have to, as a society, reframe failure and reframe those kinds of things. We do it in business. Like, we're pretty good at that because we know we're going to make a lot of mistakes in business, but we're not very good when it comes to our personal lives at allowing us to make failures because we're so worried that it's going to be attached to our identity, that it somehow says something about us at the core of our being, and it doesn't. It just says something we did, not who we are.
Right.
most of that kind of ego, desire, all of that stuff is fear. Yeah. It's fear related. Yeah. That's why we need that accomplishment to say something about us, because we have a deep fear or belief that we're not that without that. And so to be able to really get to that core identity piece, to go, I am outside of all of those things, I think is part of the journey and part of that walk. Because I know if I get into a room and I'm trying to be the life of the party and name dropping and sharing all these stories and everything else, it's usually because I'm so insecure. I'm insecure in that moment because I don't know if I belong in that room. So then I'm going to end up doing all these things to feel belonging because I'm actually really insecure. So I now know when I go into rooms and I have people that I'm like, oh, wow, they've got a lot of ego, a lot of this. I actually have a lot of empathy because I know where that's coming from. That's actually coming from a deep place of insecurity. And I might even go and key in on that and try to help that person by just however I can do that. But it does give me a lot of empathy. It used to drive me nuts because we can smell our own. That's me. There are moments if I'm insecure in my marriage or I'm insecure in my relationships, I might find myself stepping back into that pattern of being that person. What's wild is in the last probably 5 years, again, because of a lot of therapy and my wife and everything else, but I'm like much quieter in rooms and people are almost like, oh, wow. And it's actually because I'm healthier. It's not because I'm reserved or I'm unhealthy. It's actually, I'm not coming into a space going, man, I need to find identity here. I need to secure my identity here.
I edited out 20 to 25 minutes of our interview with Mike McDonald, including a lot of information on the Bible Project and how it's being used around the world. Frankly, the whole interview is fascinating. You can find it all in episode 105. Entitled Confronting Fear and Facing Risk. By the way, if you're not taking advantage of what the Bible Project offers, you're really missing out. The website is BibleProject.com and the YouTube channel is Bible Project with no space. Thanks for listening to the Throwing Mountains Podcast.